Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday, the 23rd of October. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock and an absolute pleasure to be in your company this morning. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff. If some of that stuff you have questions about or comments or concerns, outrage, rage, you can just check in with us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you.
I've never heard of anybody being enraged. You always hear outrage.
Outrage.
Is there such a thing as enrage?
I assume that's just rage.
Oh, I see. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I've been in rage for a long time.
Yes, in and out of rage, right? Well, we welcome the voice you just heard is that of Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. One of the happiest days of the week is when I get to talk to Ira. How are you, sir?
I'm okay. Good to see you all. And just to get it out of the way, thanks for paying attention to this matter. This is my new closing line. Borrowing it from the president.
Yes, thank you for
your attention to this matter.
To this matter, and whatever that matter may be.
No, we don't know. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. we welcome acting department. Is this right? Yeah. Is that right? Acting department head of cognitive science, Tetherless World, senior constellation professor of computer, web, and cognitive science. I hesitated on that because that's not what I wrote last night. Okay, so that's been corrected by our wonderful producing team.
I have three others, Joe. So it's
no,
just,
okay,
it's, you know,
all
it's
right.
Like, I don't want to be competing with Fran. I listened to her intro the other day, and I said, I got to cut mine down.
All right. So Jim Anwer is with us, and he does all the stuff I just mentioned. So good,
thank you for your attention to that matter.
And I love Mark Whitman for many, many, many reasons, but not the least of which is his four-word introduction, Wall Street investment banker.
I couldn't compete with length, so I figured I'd try to go the other way, and Sarah LeDuc did not let me go with that guy. So
that guy. That dude. Welcome all. We are waiting for Sienna Freeman Tolbert. At least I think we're waiting for Sienna Freeman Tolbert. I have her on the docket today, but if she is not here, we probably screwed it up. But if she is here, then she'll be by in a little bit.
Well, at least if the mistake wasn't her fault, at least you publicly sold her out, Joe.
Well, the reason I didn't mean to publicly sell her out, I wanted people to know that, there's sort of a balance of all this. Like, we try to figure out, different ideas and thoughts. And so Sienna was to be a part of it. But we'll see what happens. All right.
Yeah, no offense. I like you guys, but I am missing her.
Yes, I understand. So are we. And maybe she's just here. She'll be here. Let's go to what is happening in our world and what is making news. And, this is a story I thought this was interesting because yesterday we talked about this story for a little bit. It wasn't our top story, but it was a secondary story. And Jay Jochnowitz, who is the editorial editor at the Times Union, or one of them, he said, it's interesting because we were. Oh, there she is. There she is. Excellent. Sienna Freeman Tolbert has joined us, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. And we are thrilled that she is here and safe and sound.
Yes, I had to manually put down the garage door this morning. And yes, it was humbling.
And then that just screws you all up for the whole day, right? Yeah. It's good to have you here. Thank you very much.
I remember a time when I didn't have to, you had to pull down the thing.
Exactly. But the sun was shining into the The sensor, yes. And so I spent about 5 minutes trying to put it down before I clicked. That was the delay.
Oh.
That was the delay. I didn't just jump out and do it.
All right. Well, that is it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us. Okay, so here's the so yesterday we were talking about the story, and J. Jochnowitz said, you know, the stories that are like truly meaningful of a story about Russia, the story about a House member not being sworn in, and he said, you know, we're spending this time on something like the White House being torn down, but I'm sorry, after seeing yesterday, I don't know how we don't talk about sort of what is happening there. We will talk about other issues as well. However, the question in the Washington Post this morning is, can anyone stop Trump's teardown of the East Wing? To which I would like say, no. Maybe too late. Like, it looks pretty bad now. I don't, you know, it's half a building, so I don't know. President Trump's plan to build a White House ballroom has underscored an oft-overlooked aspect of presidential power. No one could stop the president from tearing down much of the East Wing this week. And no one probably ever thought that that was going to be an issue. But here we go. The next stage of the project is also likely to proceed with few restraints. The key panel slated to review the president's construction plan is now stocked with Trump allies ready to approve them. Photos of construction teams knocking down portions of the East Wing first revealed by the Washington Post on Monday, and I read from the Washington Post this morning, have rattled city residents, historians, politicians, and, yes, historic preservationists, many of whom contended that Trump was wrongfully tearing apart the People's House, which is what the White House is referred to, the People's House, to build his long-desired ballroom. It's not his house, it's your house, and he's destroying it. Hillary Clinton, who battled Trump for the presidency in 2016, wrote on social media. Others contend that Trump's shifting projections and promises, such as pledging in July that the ballroom wouldn't interfere, quote unquote, with the White House, that they were separate projects, and that he would have great reverence for the building, and increasing his estimate of cost and how many people will fit in the building illustrate the need for more transparency. Conservative commentator Byron York said Trump, quote, needs to tell the public now what he's doing with the East Wing of the White House and then tell the people why he didn't tell them before he started to actually do it, which I think is fairly obvious, but yet I understand the point. Rebecca Miller is the executive director of the D.C. Preservation League, a nonprofit that advocates for protecting historic sites in Washington. She said dozens of concerned citizens from the city and around the country have called and emailed her to express outrage. Miller said she has had to explain that the White House, because of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, is exempt from the required reviews that other federal agencies must undergo when seeking to alter government property. Our hands are tied, Miller said, adding that normally government officials discuss major projects with preservationists, but not this time. It's very frustrating that there's nothing that the organization can do from a legal or advocacy perspective. This was pointed out in several of the news articles, which I think is interesting. Some of the work that is being done is difficult to see from a public viewpoint. But in the Treasury building, there's some direct lines where you can go and see what they're doing. The Treasury Department on Monday and Tuesday put out messaging to all of their employees, don't you dare take photos of the construction or destruction that is being done at the White House. With that said, there's still a great number of pictures and videos that are out there of the building being, to be friendly, altered.
Well,
Mark.
You know, Joe, when I first waved my give a meter over this, it didn't have much response. But I thought about it again, and you and the listeners won't be surprised. I actually do have something to say. This whole thing is a primetime example of why folks end up turning to populists who smash not just norms, but laws. You know, the White House, as you said, is exempt from many preservation rules, giving Trump, the presidency, some latitude. But critics rightfully say that he's pushing a vanity project. It's wrapped in half-truths, lies, and it'll end up in ballooning costs. My under-over for the final cost, if we ever get a true accounting, is $750 million. Mark that down. There's a reason he's bypassing these laws. It's to get something done. The White House is a living building that's arguably not fit for purpose, and the guy in charge of the place wants to do something different with it. Of course, the liberal response is pretty emotional and not very effectual. If you heard Anderson Cooper last night, I thought the guy was going to – I actually happened to listen to his opening. I listened to it on radio, but I thought he might cry.
I agree. I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he sounded like he was about – he was about to lose it.
Right. And if you listen to read the Washington Post article that you gave to us today, the myriad of committees and approvals and laws, even for the president to alter the White House, was to me absolutely staggering. And it's emblematic of why in this country we can't get nice things. I'm not justifying what Trump's doing, but it's emblematic of the problem. You know, politicians from New York City to Albany worry about how do we solve the housing crisis centered particularly in New York City? What could we ever do to revitalize municipalities up and down the Hudson River? Oh, I don't know. How about a bullet train, which would solve all those problems and be financially compelling? But without central planning in this country, like they have in, say, China, where they get things like that done, we can never have a project that would require cutting through so much red tape, so much parochialism, and so much political short-sightedness. So this whole thing is just emblematic of why the only politician who can really get stuff done is one who's hyperactive and willing to act illegally, and basically a pox on both of our or all of our houses for this whole thing.
Yeah, so. I was just going to say I had a similar reaction at first. I was like, okay, I'm not surprised that Trump wants to upgrade a building. Like, that's not surprising to
me.
He's
got to drive through.
Exactly.
Now.
But when the images came out, the optics was were disgusting to me because we're in the middle of a shutdown. I'm seeing on one station people, federal workers lined up in D.C. at food banks to get food. And then we have the president of the United States renovating. You know, I think the optics and the timing, if anything, is terrible when you know there's millions of people not being paid and wondering whether or not they're going to get paid on November 1st. And then the second thing, and then I'll end, is when he said, oh, we're paying with private donations. That's when I started doing a little digging. Because I was like, wait, is this East Wing going to look like a hockey arena? It's going to have like Amazon. And like, I was like, what does this look like? How do we do this? But there is a legal, since it's through the National Park Services, they can get private donations apparently if it's only for a specific purpose. But I had to look into that too because I was like worried.
Well, we had the Musk dealership on the lawn when, remember that?
Yes,
when
we
had all, I mean, yeah.
I don't know. It feels so long ago. We're like, it was a few months ago.
I know, it was a long time ago.
The $230 million he wants from the Justice Department could then be just transferred over to the building department.
Well.
No, because he's asked for that to go to his personal.
Right. Well,
this is personal.
So then he would have to make a donation.
He said he might.
Although.
He might make. Oh, well.
Well, there's. Yeah, well. So, you know, what's interesting is while I agree with you on sort of there are often too many laws and restrictions, things like that, I'm often frustrated reading about that. In D.C., and for the mall and for the president. There's always been just a lot of agreements. It hasn't been a whole set of very obstructionist laws. Presidents have almost always been allowed to do small changes to the White House, and then big changes went through the Committee for the Preservation of the White House, as they would for any historic building, right? So what Trump did is he put two people onto that committee, which is a two-person committee, as I understand it, or there's two people who do the final review or something. It's been reported differently. But he started by saying this is going to be a cheap project that won't actually impact the White House. All we're doing is upgrading the ballroom. Now, the East Wing ballroom is going to be larger than the rest of the White House. It's going to be, there's photos now of what he has proposed. It's completely lined in gold. And in fact, it turns out to be a mirror of a ballroom he has in Mar-a-Lago, which is where he holds his $1 million a plate fundraisers. Right. So, I mean, this is a vanity project. This is not a renewal of a part of a building that was falling over. This is not we had a small room that wasn't functioning. If you look at some of the history of what's been in the East Wing, you know, it was primarily used for small receptions of great import. Right. Now it's going to be too big for that. Right. You're not going to bring in 20 people to talk about some important international issue and host them in a room that holds 1,000 people who, you know, can go to a party. I mean, it's completely different. And, you know, Alan Chartok used to, every time Trump's name came up, say, lying, lying, liar. And I was like, well, you know, he's right. Okay, Trump said about this project on the air, on the record, in front of cameras, this project will not require any real damage to the White House. It will not have a high cost. It will not be anything other than a small renovation, like when I paved over the Rose Garden. So I'm sorry. It's not my liberalism that's being offended here. It's my belief that there's got to be some decency somewhere in the federal government. And almost every other story we're going to discuss today is going to be exactly that same response, that this whole movement that says what we're after is just to sort of remove the federal government, make it so that it's small enough that it can fit in a bathtub and drown, famous quote, right, is doing it by giving more and more power to the federal government to do whatever the heck they want all over the country, all over the world. And if I sound outraged by this, it's because I've become outraged by this. And, you know, I've mentioned this before. I'll stop real fast. I'll take it up again after that.
We don't even have time for you to stop real fast. We'll take a break. We'll be back and we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we are talking about the construction project at the White House. We will go with those words. And basically, as the East Wing of the White House is being torn down, two interesting things I thought. First of all, one of the items in the East Wing of the White House is the Nixon bowling alley. So that's that is something. Now, Truman had the first bowling alley, but that was in the West Wing, and then it was moved for Nixon to go in the East Wing, mm-hmm. and is used by, you know, whoever, I guess, private, but it would all be private, obviously, of who could be in there. The other thing that's in the East Wing, the big thing that's in the East Wing, besides the current ballroom, is the office of Melania Trump, the First Lady. So I think that's interesting as well.
We also have the JFK frolicking swimming pool, which was covered over to build the press conference room.
That's correct. Yes.
Well, they don't need a press conference room anymore.
No, they don't.
Yes. So, so now, Jim, I had to interrupt you, and I hope you will take this in the spirit of which I mean it, which is I got you in mid-rant. Yes. So I want you to continue.
So let me finish the rant. Right. So here's the thing, right? I mean, even if you wanted to go with the fact that, theoretically, the president is supposed to ask a particular board for permission. He stacked the board. The board was planned to to approve it this coming week, I think it was, he's already tearing it down. He's not even waiting for his own appointed board to make the decision saying it's okay. I mean, it's just to me mind-boggling. And it's the same thing, you know, send in the troops, then you get a restraining order, then you get an appeal, then you get an appeal on the appeal, then maybe eventually it gets to the Supreme Court, which only rules on that one particular city or one particular place. And it goes on, you know, and it all is, we have a government where, so here, I'll tell you a story. I was sitting with one of the generals who I used to hang around with, who had been one of the first people, retired generals, who used to be one of the first people into Russia when we sort of had detente and were starting to make joint plans with them and we were friends. And he said, you know, the thing that the Russians admired most about our form of government is that no one person could come in and change everything. And our general said, you know, the one thing we admire about your form of government is you can get things done. And the problem is there's no middle. But the speed that this is being done, the lack of even respect for their own things, and the fact that this is all being done in the name of, quote, smaller government, right? So in the name of smaller government, I'm sending National Guard troops into your city, right? I mean, this is just getting to me. And, you know, my wife is, I've mentioned on the show before, quite progressive, left-wing, has been for years, you know, I've been, no, it's okay. We have a system that has checks and balances. They're all gone, right? And we've learned what it's like to have a dictator. And to have somebody who can make whatever decisions they want and make them come true. And then, like Joe was saying, you know, you're not allowed to take pictures, right? Why? This is reality happening. We just don't want anyone to know what the reality is. It was the same thing with some of the targeting of... I'm sorry, I'll stop.
Are you ranted out?
No, but we have four other stories that I get to rant on.
We'll get Teresa in here and let them have a rant off.
You know, it's really funny. I do say it's true. I sit here with Therese, and I can't believe she's going on and on and on like this. But today, I just
it's that.
Well, may
and I woke up in a good mood.
At your own risk. Go ahead.
By the way, the 1,000-seat ballroom, which has more means by your suggestion that they can't do anything unless there's 1,000 people. You know, the local Holiday Inn takes care of that by putting up in dividers, and you can have several small events. But that aside, listen, this is literally a bully in a china shop. Everything that you guys have said, I agree with in terms of the obnoxiousness and the presumptuousness of Trump doing it and asking for permission later or being asked to uphold questions later. I was gonna say much of what you guys said. I don't want to repeat it, but it's certainly just the latest in a long list. And at some point, somebody has got to speak up who he can listen to and can help sway his base, because his base is cheering him along.
I mean, the only thing, you know, the only branch that's sort of working is the judicial branch right now, right? And it's all, the only thing that's working is litigation. And unfortunately, litigation doesn't work fast enough, as fast as Congress would to do an oversight of what's going on or to question and bring people in about what's happening. They're trying to look through how they could. Is there any litigation that can be brought? You know, did he not follow the proper procedure by not getting it approved prior to the, you know, they're looking into it, but that's the only thing we have. And, you know, the wheels of justice are slow.
Right. Okay. So there's one group who yesterday, it was a wing of the National Park Service. It came up like it was the Friends of the National Park Service.
Exactly.
They do have some power, but I'm not exactly sure how this is. But they said that their investigation will take between 6 to 8 weeks. Well, okay. It's going to have a roller coaster by then. I don't know. Like, I just don't understand. It seems as though we have to figure out how to do, if we want to, it seems as though we have to figure out how to do those things faster and be able to bring it under control. And I do wonder, just thinking of security and other things, did nobody question this as they started opening the gates and they were letting in all the construction materials going, all the vehicles going in and out?
Well, he suggested that it wasn't going to be impacting the rest of the building. So everybody said, okay, here come the cranes.
I would suggest the country and we should focus on what really matters, and this ain't it. I will say, there was a great quote from U.S. District Judge William Young, who said that his wife said the following about Trump. He seems to be winning. He ignores everything, keeps bullying ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, so, right. So, and you go ahead.
Drew. No, actually, I had a question for Santa.
It was not too complicated.
I don't know. You may. I hope you know the answer, which is, okay, so virtually everything that gets brought into court, the government sends in their lawyers, and then it goes through and through. Who's paying for that? Who pays those government lawyers? I mean, that's coming.
We pay for that.
Yeah.
That's the Department of Justice.
Yes. I mean, has anyone actually looked at what the cost to the American economy is for all of these fights and appeals and things like that? Because it's got to be in the millions. I mean, today, granted, today it was announced that our federal debt is $32 trillion, $1 trillion more than it was a year ago. But anyway.
I mean, even after this administration is over, I mean, the litigation that's going to continue to roll through, right, due to the injustices that's happened, people may be suing because they were imprisoned because they were U.S. citizens when they weren't supposed to be in prison. Like, all this has to be litigated. Whether or not they win, that's going to be a huge cost to the U.S. government to figure this out.
Well, we're not talking of the payment that you're questioning. I mean, not to be facetious, but aren't these lawyers on retainer? In other words, if you were paying by the hour, I know if the lawyer started the clock as soon as the phone rang, there might be $500 million worth of bills.
But it's a different system, right?
But it's a different system.
For the federal government, the Department of Justice, they have a whole slew of attorneys that are paid their annual salary, so they're not on paid on retainer. So unless you need special counsel, or have to go out.
That's right.
They have had to do, but yeah, okay.
All right. This topic has generated a lot of mail.
Oh, wow.
I am going to read some of the letters. We'll take a break in between, but we'll start the process. Steve says, in light of eviscerating democracy, destroying the economy, and making the United States stupider and sicker, erecting a Vegas Versailles monstrosity is a drop in the fire hose of atrocities, says Steve. We go to Martha. We can have nice things, but I guess it depends on how you define nice things. A gaudy ballroom is not my definition of nice. Nice things like healthcare, food stamps, food for the hungry, quality education for all, affordable housing. That would be my definition of nice things all, says Martha. We then said, don't forget that after the ballroom, there will be a replica of the Arc de Triomphe added to Washington. That's true. The arch, if you have not seen the mock-up of the arch, and it's not too hard to see it because it seems to be in most shots when he's out and talking to people, he puts it on the lectern to show, because he often mentions it. But yes, the arch seems to be the next project. We go to Carolyn, who says, no, this is not an example of getting things done. This is an example of Trump, the spoiled brat, doing whatever he wants. Then we check in with Nick. Once again, if any Democratic president did what Trump is doing to the White House, Republican Trump apologists would be blowing a gasket. Republican hypocrisy is breathtaking. And no, Democrats would not accept this from a Democratic president.
I will say, just very briefly, I just keep thinking about it. I'm thinking about, how is this authorized during a shutdown? Like, is it, because during a shutdown, the only agencies that are supposed to be working are essential, right? So we think about the essential workers. Like, how is this authorized during a, we're in a federal shutdown. I think, like,
I mean, who's paying the construction workers?
But if you,
it's not essential.
If you do whatever the hell you want to do, it doesn't matter, right? This is a letter from Wendy. After years of listening to the roundtable, I now find your program virtually unlistenable. You give a standing platform now to people who justify and excuse Trump's behavior. I just want to know what you were listening to over the last half hour. Was that you? Was that Mark?
That could be how they interpret it.
I don't know. Look, I appreciate the opportunity to clarify it.
We should all be crying about Trump's destruction of the East Wing with no transparency or accountability about his historic preservation cost, no plans being shared. It is the people's house. Just stop. I keep trying to come back to the roundtable, and each time I'm hit with rationalizations that make me angry and leave me feeling ill. I guess I'm a snowflake who needs a trigger warning to listen to your damn show. I added the last part, but go ahead.
Here's the thing. I think when I even agree with you, Mark, I think we're so numb to it because there's so much other things going on in the world that listening to someone talk about the East Wing seems small on the scale. For me, in my life, and what I do in immigration, right? I have people being detained every day. I have people who can't get out. I have people, you know, I'm thinking about that. And so an East Wing renovation is low on my list. It's important, but it's low on my list, you know, right? But I think, to take your point, is what you're saying is that it's just another symbol of, like, of the destroying of democracy and what we do and our steps. Right. And I think I understand that, but I'm just saying...
Yeah. See, to me, this was just the straw that broke the camel's back. And I don't know why I had such an emotional reaction to this. But I think it's, you know, it's the combination of things. OK, so one, we have a shutdown where virtually everybody in Congress on both sides says the only person who can end this is Trump, who doesn't care. Second, we have this work going on during this shutdown where we have, you know, as you said, federal workers sitting out there in food lines and somebody's paying for these cranes and construction crews and things like that. Three, we had Trump standing in front of cameras showing plans that turn out to have been complete lies and saying this won't affect any other part of the White House. This won't be a major change. So to me, it was like it just encapsulated the four things that I find most hypocritical and anger-inducing in this government. So, yeah, you know, if this had been the only thing Trump did, I'd have come in and said, well, you know, it would have been nice if he followed policy. And then if Mark said, well, you know, there are too many policies, we could have said, well, maybe they could be streamed. But this is part of this very big picture, and I think that's what your listener is.
He's only been president 10 months. There's plenty of time.
All kinds of hits to talk about.
But it's just that this one brought everything together in such a...
Well, I think one of the ironies is that in 100 years from now, people are going to look at that White House complex, or campus is probably a better word, and say... not even think about how it came about. I mean, I think an argument could be made for the need for the project. Although I must admit, 1,000-seat ballroom seems to me a little excessive. But nevertheless, it enabled them to have events that they right now can't have.
You could have the White House Correspondents' Dinner at the ballroom,
and then you can make sure nobody comes
in.
So when Trump doesn't
go to it, he'll only be across the hall.
That's right. Yeah. You can still listen in.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think, as the others have said, the issue is less, at least for me, the project, the scope of the project, et cetera. It's just his continued failure to follow the rules. And
I just, since I was mentioned, I appreciate the chance to clarify.
Of course.
My opening.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, can I come back to that? Because then we have another panel member that got a cheap shot at them, too. So we can do both of those under in one fell swoop. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion and a barn burner this morning. So a lot going on. You wanted to clarify your remarks.
This is stomach churning for me. I think I sort of implied or stated that I think it's emblematic of much, if not most, of what's wrong with Trump and his administration. But there's a nugget in here that I think once we're done being aghast, you need to take a breath and realize, for instance, when you read through the Washington Post and the list of informal and formal approvals and the process that, quote unquote, you're supposed to go through, you realize why populism, not only in the United States, but worldwide, has such a draw for citizens. And so my point is this is and the left, instead of tearing or even once you become aghast, take a deep breath. This is emblematic of not only what's wrong with the right, but a lot that we have to fix in this nation and in much of the many of the democracies around the world. That was my point. Not that I was endorsing it, for God's sake. My answer to this, this is easy. There's got to be a Smithsonian within a half a mile that would be an amazing venue for 1,000-plus person dinners for the president every and any time they wanted. It drives me nuts that they didn't take a simple fix like that. But we all know that this isn't about... not about that. But it is an amazing microcosm of what's wrong, not only with Donald Trump, but politics in the West.
This from Brian. You guys are a bunch of professors used to using obscene amounts of money being wasted on new buildings all around you, but in the regular world, us lowly non-professors appreciate actual history. Jim?
I guess am I the only professor here?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So I will tell you that my campus is working on a 20-year plan to figure out how we're going to get around all the deferred maintenance that has been caused by the fact that to meet many of the government rules, we had to do things. But now the government is threatening to take away our overhead. Now, just so you know, people say, well, isn't it obscene that a university charge it? So overhead is when I get a grant, my campus gets some of the money. So if I'm getting a grant to help cure cancer and I get $2 million, say $750,000, that could go, I'm not sure I got the numbers right, to the campus. Okay. However, that pays for the electricity, the machines, No one has pointed out the fact that those very contractors you just mentioned who have those things around the thing. Do you know what the overhead rate is at Raytheon? When I was a funding agent, and that was 20 years ago, so I'm sure it's much higher now, it was 160%, right? So in other words, to get $50,000 of work out of them, I had to pay them 50 times 160. So that would be, you know, I used to be able to do math. I'm a professor. But a lot of money, a lot of extra money. And what was their argument? Well, we needed to keep the facilities going. We need for this. So, you know, when we talk about new buildings being, almost all of those come from donors. Almost all of those are in plans. And yes, he's right. But every campus has its own set of how they do the same sort of thing we've been talking about that Trump ignored. So the president of my university cannot just simply walk in and say, guess what? We're taking half of our university budget and building such and such. They have to show where the funds are coming from. They have to get a board of trustees approved. I mean, you know, it's not as bad as Mark says, as if they wanted to do it for government. Yes, that I agree. If we wanted to do this in Albany for a state building, But it goes through processes and it has counterweights. And It's based on the assumption that people are doing this stuff in good faith. And that's really my angst at the moment, is the same people who are saying we need to reduce the size of the government, and that's why we're not going to pay for your food stamps, and that's why we're going to make your kids stay home, you know, not have education. That's why we're going to make you have to decide between whether you're going to take your life-saving medicines or feed your children, right? Because we want to build these things in the White House, or we want to send federal troops somewhere, or we're going to find a new way of doing it, let alone the information control and all that that we'll get to later. I'm sorry, as a professor, I have seen this. I have protested some of this, right? But it's not as arbitrary. It's not that someone can just come in and say, we're doing it. It goes through checks and balances.
But there's a responsibility of organizations, too, to realize what they can do, what they can't do, what is feasible, yes, and what isn't feasible. And I say this as someone who has worked at WAMC headquarters for a few decades now. And in 1943, this building was a car dealership. And still, to this day, on a warm day, it smells like an oil change.
Yes.
And
that's a new slogan for the radio station.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. The board. I won't say whose cologne I thought that was.
No. And the studios that we're in were, you know, bays for Studebakers, and vermin, vermin the size of toaster ovens. But I don't know. I think there comes a point where you have to. You mentioned about medicine, and I just want to read this letter, and then we'll go to a break. Make sure I have the right one. Deborah says, or Devorah, I apologize. I would love to have the bandwidth to be outraged about the demolition of the East Wing, but we are struggling to find affordable health care for a 25-year-old daughter, a stroke survivor who will age out of our family insurance plan in 4 very short months. She has a master's degree, she's paying off, and her entry-level job does not offer health insurance. And, I mean, that puts it into perspective. That's exactly what you were saying.
I have a 38-year-old child who is disabled, is unable to work. I've mentioned this before. I actually have their permission to get into details if anyone wants to hear it, but I won't bore you with them. But suffice to say, if their parents could not afford their health care, they would be out on the street and homeless, period. Because the Medicaid is actually covering most of what they need to stay alive, not what they need to get better, right, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there was a period where they simply could not leave the house for physical reasons to go buy food. So they had to get everything through Uber and outside orders and things like that. Again, costs more.
To the letter writer, we thank you for sharing that with us, and we wish you the best of luck.
Yes, please. And you have my deepest sympathy and empathy.
I think we should put a bow on this East Wing thing, and I think that if I'm hearing us correctly, we're all outraged by the manner in which Trump has proceeded here. It's just another one of the ways he's proceeded on other things, and there are going to be a lot more unless somehow, finally, people in this country who support Trump contact their congresspeople who are supporting Trump and say, wait a minute, this is not the way this country is supposed to be run. If as long as there is radio silence, this is going to continue, and we're going to be sitting here every week talking about Trump and the next thing that he's done.
The bow is tied, signed, sealed, delivered.
Excellent. We'll My old back. Editor skills.
We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to move on to other subjects, and we welcome your letters as always. Let's talk about Russian oil company sanctions and the Russian sanctions. U.S. imposes sanctions on Russian oil companies after strikes on Ukraine kill seven. Renewed Russian attacks following the apparent collapse of a planned Trump-Putin meeting show that a negotiated solution to the war remains distant. In a move reflecting the Trump administration's waning patience with Russian President Vladimir Putin, the Treasury Department on Wednesday imposed sanctions against two of Russia's largest oil companies. The department cited Putin's lack of serious commitment to a peace process to end the war in Ukraine in a statement announcing the measures, which came after overnight Russian attacks on Ukraine that killed seven people, including two children, and the apparent cancellation of a planned meeting next week between President Donald Trump and Putin in Hungary. Wednesday's sanctions cut off the Russian firms from American banking systems and financial institutions, essentially barring them from operating in U.S. dollars. Violators, including foreign financial institutions, can be subject to stiff penalties, including cascading sanctions. Individuals can be subject to criminal prosecution. That from the Washington Post. How big a deal is this, Mark Whitman?
It could be extraordinarily helpful to the Ukrainians, but the issue is you've got to temper it by asking how permanent is anything that Donald Trump does. Once Putin realized he wasn't going to get to Kyiv in a matter of days or weeks, he started playing the long game, and he started out waiting out Western resolve. Part of that strategy always depends on time, fatigue, and politics. And sanctions that were helpful, they bit, but they didn't strangle. And it was also dependent on us and our allies who talk about unity but count the costs. And a Biden administration and still a Trump administration that had largely handcuffed Ukraine in terms of how muscular its response to Russia could be, as well as voters who stopped paying attention once they got bored with this. Putin has clearly for years been hoping for Trump's return. And he's the one Trump has said that, you know, Zelensky has no cards. Moscow liked hearing that, but it's clearly not true. Ukraine has held out, fought harder, and been more successful in countering Russia than anyone thought was possible initially, and now, frankly, even over the longer run. But it's clear, you know, the one card that's always been in Putin's hands since this began has been Trump. And he's played Trump incredibly well. Despite Trump's bi-weekly threats, he's done nothing but retreat from those, almost nothing but retreat from those threats up until this measure. Now, this measure is interesting because it is something that's possible or facilitated by the fact that world oil prices are at very low levels, in part, I might add, because of the diminution in worldwide economic activity brought on by Trump and Trump's tariffs and the economic uncertainty he's sown throughout the world. But because this doesn't threaten to drive oil prices through the ceiling, it also in part, not only because of low growth, but because Europe has largely detoxed itself from Russian energy. This is a way to tighten our stranglehold around the Russians. And it is also clear that even within the last week, the range that Ukraine is using Western arms suggests that at least NATO and probably the U.S. has been complicit in lengthening the mileage or the kilometers will let them bomb inside of Russia, which is also a threat to Russia, particularly given that they're afraid of further degradation of their energy production. But there is one, you know, if this all comes to pass as we hope, and it does continue to put pressure on Russia, there's one thing that the allies do need to keep in mind that's been little talked about, which is part of why Putin did this was the war is peace I can crack down internally if I have a nation at war and not lose my grip on power. Remember, Putin's the only one in this conflict who's left his capital for fear of his life during this war, if you remember during the mini revolt that he that we saw in Russia. So the West has to figure out a way for Putin, if we are really going to start strangling Russia, which it now seems we're in a better position to do than we've ever been militarily and economically, we do have to figure out a way for him to see a way through for his regime when this is all done. But that may be overly optimistic. Trump changes his mind every couple weeks. He seems to be one of Putin's most effective cards in his hand. Hopefully that's changed, but I can't guarantee it.
I would just say quickly that we know Trump wants this Nobel Peace Prize next year, right? We know that this is what he wants. So I think that's what you're seeing, actually. I think he mentioned it during one.
He mentions it every day, every other day, right?
Yeah. So unfortunately, I think that's his incentive. But I think whereas this is, you know, a move in the right direction in terms of Russia, I would just say that if he really wanted to do something that was helpful, he would give direct aid to Ukraine, give them more aid so that they can help fight. I think that's the only way that he'll really show Putin that he means business.
I think I agree. I think we're at a tipping point. If these sanctions, which are going to further damage an already weak economy in Russia, if they don't motivate Putin to come to the table, then it looks like there's Trump may have to start sending some of those Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, and then where does that go from there? So the potential is always, but now I think particularly there, for this to really escalate into a war situation that drags us in somehow even more than we currently are, unless the economy in Russia is such that Putin has got to figure out a way to declare himself a victor and end this thing.
Yeah, but, you know, I think the sanctions, Russia is run by the person, by someone with the power that Trump would like to have, who can simply make sure that that money is going to the oligarchs, to his government, to his needs, to whatever he wants to do in the military. And he doesn't really care if his people starve. Right. He doesn't really care if the communist social net we were so angry about, this whole socialist system. He doesn't really care if that stuff is not getting funded. And that's where the oil cuts
are. Have you seen the movie Death of Stalin?
No.
Oh, you've seen it, Joe, Death of Stalin.
Yeah.
There comes a point in time, because obviously that's fiction based on fact, but the people who let Putin do what he wants to do at some point are going to rise up.
Oh, I agree. The question is, so
you never see
how soon?
You never see Putin standing next to an open window, do you?
Yeah, I think we're missing two. I think we're missing one pressure point that we have on Putin. Early on in the war, we thought the body count would start to scare him. And a lot of the reason why people in the West thought that was if you look at the precedent of Afghanistan and the Mothers of the Fallen that mounted a opposition movement inside of Russia at the time that was ultimately, people say, a big motivating factor. What we missed was that Putin knew that had happened, and he infiltrated that early. There's not a lot about this, but there was some discussion early in the war. He infiltrated that movement so as to deaden it. But if you look at the rate of loss now of Russians to Ukrainians for periods of this war, it's running at 5-1. The way Putin's got over that is by economically incentivizing less economically well-off fighters and families to basically be put into the meat grinder for the benefit of their current and maybe even future generations, depending on the size of the payment. But that's costly, and it is so costly, and the economics are so difficult for Putin that it may be the case that he's got to start straight up conscripting people. And that's another pressure point. And frankly, what I hope here more than the sanctions is that someone has gotten to Trump and told him, if you really do want the peace prize, the way to do this is to force Putin to the table. And the only way to do that is through force, economic and militarily.
And that's the sad part of the conversation, right, is that it comes down to this peace prize that he wants, not the war, not what's happening in Ukraine, not the amount of life lost, not anything else. What it comes down to for him is this Nobel Peace Prize that he wants, and that might be what leads to the end of the war, and that's a whole different conversation.
No, and it just seems like everybody is, uh, it, 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 it's at the top of every conversation, and it's the elephant in the room, and it just, I mean, to me, just is the silliest thing in the world that that's what we're worried about.
The fact that he can be led by this shiny object is disgusting to me when you're talking about human life, but...
Well, it's the adulation he's after. It explains why he did the big, beautiful bill we talked about at the time, the parallels between Dr. Frankenstein looking for adulation of his peers and why it is that Trump thought that the big, beautiful bill would bring that to him and why he wants this and why he wants a big gold ballroom back to that. I mean, it really all does come back to the ballroom, doesn't it, Joe?
Well,
name five Nobel Peace Prize winners.
That's easy.
Barack Obama. That's the only one that cares about.
Mandela and de Klerk.
I was going to say in the last 10 years, but voila. Yes. But you know what I mean? Voila. Like, I mean, it's not like this is, it's fleeting.
Well, for his 4-year consideration, real, he can run that video of him wearing the crown, bombing excrement on the people. There's a person you want to honor with the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes, the person who said the Department of Defense really should be called the Department of War, so that I can get a Peace
Prize.
Well,
not only says it, he's changed the signs.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, we're doing our favorite hits. Golf of America.
That's right. We're doing our hits. All right, let's move on to other issues this morning, and let's talk about Next Generation Press Corps is the title of this topic. The Defense Department said that dozens of new reporters had agreed to sign the Pentagon's rules on reporting, which have been rejected by most major news organizations. The Defense Department announced Wednesday that a, quote, new generation of journalists would be given access to the Pentagon after they signed rules on access to the building that were rejected by all the major news organizations. The announcement posted on X by Sean Parnell, the chief Defense Department spokesman, did not name the journalists or the outlets, but numerous right-wing pro-Trump online outlets said they were among those that have agreed to the rules, including, get ready, including The Gateway Pundit, Human Events, Frontlines, which is an arm of Turning Point USA, The National Pulse, and my personal favorite,
Lindell TV.
Yes.
And just for the boy. Listeners, for those who don't know, Lindell is the My Pillow dude.
Yes. The close to being bankrupt My Pillow guy. Last week, the Pentagon began restricting access to the sprawling building, allowing in only journalists who signed a 21-page document governing everything from soliciting tips to parking to photography. Dozens of journalists from national outlets, including the major TV news networks, Wire Services, and the New York Times and other newspapers, declined to sign the policy, citing concerns that it curbed their First Amendment rights and handed in their press passes. There was a video a moment ago being shown on CNN of the reporters leaving the Pentagon with their boxes filled with their belongings after cleaning out their desks this morning. Ira, as a longtime press guy and a publisher, former publisher of a major newspaper, what do you make of the Next Generation Press Corps idea?
I'm going to make a prediction, and it's the safest prediction I'm going to make all year, and that is that there will be a major story regarding the Pentagon that the government would not want to get out because it'll be generated by one or more reporters from the news outlets that are pulled away from the Pentagon. And because they're now going to tap their sources, of which there are many, and they've built up over years and years of experience and relationships. And the news that the government doesn't want to get out, or unless it gets out its way, is going to get out. this business of the Pentagon has lit a fire under major news organizations, including some on the right.
Fox.
And right, including Fox. So I'm not really concerned about the Pentagon and Trump succeeding in covering up, because there are going to be too many reporters out there looking, and they have sources that are going to help them break news. That's my prediction.
Jim?
So I actually agree with you, Ira, but there are some other parts of this that have not been gotten as much public attention that I think are also really scary. So Pentagon employees have now been told they're not allowed to talk to Congress people or anyone else without going through an authorization process, which goes almost all the way up to Hegseth, if not up to Hegseth. They're not being allowed to talk to a lot of other people they necessarily may need to talk to. So, for example, for 3 years, I worked at the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, which funds most of the early research into things that are needed by our government to help keep us safe. And I would have Congress people coming to me and saying, why are you doing that work? And I would explain it. And then they would go back, and that could impact our budget. If they thought I had made a compelling argument, my program would get allowed to continue. And if they thought I hadn't, and, you know, they were parts of larger things. But we had these conversations going on. Those conversations can no longer, theoretically, I could, if I was sitting there, no longer talk to those people. They would have to go through the Pentagon, which has been trying to move a lot of that research money into operational money, because the president can rebudget operational money much more easily than he can rebudget other kinds of money. I could go on about some of the other things that this impacts. It's gotten out now what a lot of the generals thought about the Hegseth show, and I will leave that for another day. But and I wish Mia was here, because I think she'd be doing the rant now on sort of what this is doing to the military and the things like that.
How many people work in the Pentagon? Is it like 50,000?
Zillion. Well, I think there's 50,000 roughly directly work in the Pentagon. And then you have huge numbers of people it's very funny. I one time went to Germany with one of the people who was supporting my program, who was a colonel in the military. And I had never seen him getting saluted before, because we'd always been visiting the Pentagon, where he had to salute other people.
Well, I was just going to say that if 50,000 is anywhere near accurate, and I think it is, I think it's fairly safe to say that some of those 50,000 are going to be presenting information that needs to be publicized, and it'll get out.
Oh, I agree with you, but what I'm saying is, it's the lines of communication that have been so necessary for keeping the Pentagon functioning are now being, again, it's very Trumpized. It's, let's pull it into a central organization that will make Mark happy because they can make very fast decisions, but will make the rest of us unhappy because we don't like those decisions.
Mark, we have 90 seconds.
Look, I my only takeaway from this is, if you look at the three areas that cost Trump the most resistance in his last administration, it was defense, FBI, and the Justice Department. That's where Trump has put his lackeys, and we're seeing the consequences of that.
Hear, hear.
Agreed. I mean, I think there is, I was just looking through some case law. There is obviously case law that allows the government to restrict access of the press to certain areas. But where it's getting kind of gray is where, when you're dealing with this unclassified information and ability for the press to even operate at that level. I'm just not surprised. I'm not surprised. And I'm just really, you know, after reading the article about Congress and their lack of action, I think this this all goes back to their lack of action and lack of movement and lack of oversight. And I'm just really frustrated at that branch right now, specifically. I'm just very, very frustrated. Even implementing policies like this, well, there should be an oversight committee questioning it. You know, none of that is happening. And that's so disappointing.
Well, and we fired the only other mechanism, which was the IGs. So when I, again, when I was working for the government, a question was raised about whether the funds that were coming to our research were being well spent, and I had to go spend an hour explaining to an inspector general what the rules I was following, what rules I had waivers to, what I was doing. I got thanked on the way out. They said, thank you for your service, right? But this was how things worked. And that wasn't that they were friendly to us. They came in with a set of hostile questions because they had been told that DARPA was wasting money, but in the end, they went back and said, we're not.
We thank you for your service, but we have to go to a break. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back, and we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll wrap up after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have about 15 minutes left with each other, and we're going to get in as many topics as we possibly can. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Our panelists this morning, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Ira Fussfeld, Jim Hendler, and Mark Whitman. We go to this story, which is the Trump administration announced a second strike outside the Caribbean in a campaign against what U.S. officials say are boats carrying drugs bound for the United States. It is the second boat in the Pacific that was struck by the U.S. is as an anti-drug operation continues to expand. The strikes this week were the eighth and ninth known boat attacks that U.S. Special Operation Forces have conducted since the operation began in early September and brought the officially acknowledged death toll to 37. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth made the announcement of the latest incident yesterday afternoon. As the entire operation, the campaign seems to be expanding beyond the Caribbean, as I mentioned, this now in the Pacific. Mr. Hegseth did not provide geographic details beyond saying that the attacks had taken place in the eastern Pacific Ocean in international waters. All the previous seven attacks took place in the Caribbean. A U.S. official speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive matter said the first strike in the eastern Pacific was off the coast of Colombia. I think that's important for two reasons. One, because we now know that it's off the coast of Colombia. And second, to Ira's point, even though there are reporters who don't have access to the information within the Pentagon, an official speaking on the condition of anonymity told them exactly where it was. So there is that as well. Mark Whitman. Well, Donald, by the way, that from the New York Times.
Donald Trump has rebooted the war on terror, only he's basing it on outdated assumptions. He does have better pyrotechnics and drones, but far worse judgment. Let's talk about the assumptions. Number one, the real killer is fentanyl. It doesn't come in boats. It comes across the border, mostly from Mexico. And exactly. I think a worth of it came from Canada collectively over the course of a year or so. In addition, drug cartels now manage the process of manufacturing, transporting, and selling drugs like the production of an iPhone. The intermediate steps are modular subcontractors, and if you bomb these boat guys, some other subcontractor with a boat's going to show up, or they're going to show up with a submarine or figure out another way to get it through.
Mark, have you been watching Breaking Bad?
No, just reading the Financial Times and the Economist. Yeah. But you're right, the Breaking Bad model is apropos here. The other thing is you can't bomb addiction by throwing Hellfire missiles into the Caribbean. That's a demand side problem that you need to deal with in the United States. But like a lot that Trump doesn't like, when the solutions are hard and imperfect, That doesn't show well on TV, so Trump doesn't tend to avail himself of the effective solutions to problems. And finally, he's obviously they violated, and I'll leave Sienna to talk about this more, but every sense of jurisprudence here. It's amazing to me that they literally bombed one of these boats, picked up a survivor, and then sent the survivor back saying, well, we're not sure we just tried to kill you. But since we're not really sure you're guilty of anything, you can go on home.
Exactly. And it's because they didn't use the proper mechanism, right? There is something called the Maritime Drug Law Enforcement Act, which allows law enforcement agencies, not the military, to, you know, do actions such as this, to go after drug trafficking. And that comes with the power of a warrant, a power of subpoena, like with research, investigation. That's what's supposed to happen, rather than relying on the War Powers Resolution. So right now, what I'm really watching is, once again, Congress, because it's only the War Power Resolution's only good for 60 days. And so in early November, he can no longer take these actions without action by Congress. So what's going to happen after that? Like, what is going to happen? Are they going to authorize these actions? Are they going to fund these actions that he's taking? That's what I'm curious to see. But we all know this is about Venezuela and him in Venezuela, what's going on there, and trying to remove him. And we know that's what's actually happening right now.
Yeah, and the government will probably still be shut down in November, so he'll be able to continue doing what he wants.
Is anybody suggesting, and I don't know the answer to this, is anybody suggesting that these targets are improper? In other words, that they're bombing these boats.
Yes.
Are they doing what they supposedly want to do?
The one Maybe Ecuadorian not. That was found and sent back to Ecuador, they said they released him in Ecuador because they were like he wasn't a drug trafficker.
Right.
They didn't find
right.
anything that connected him.
So we don't know that these actions are doing what they're supposed to.
Exactly.
It's just show.
Exactly.
It's just like a video game.
We know more than that. First of all, these actions are illegal. And secondly, we know they're not doing what they're supposed to do, because if you want to unwind one of these cartel subcontracting arrangements and the whole string of them, you need to capture the folks on that boat and start to do the hard work to actually unwind the supply chain from production
exactly.
to delivery. So right. killing the people, if I said to you, Ira, the objective is to decrease the amount of cocaine coming from Venezuela or anywhere else into the United States, and the general in the room says, well, let's bomb the boat, we would all say, no, that's the exact wrong answer. If we think we have actionable intel, we need to use it effectively.
Right,
and
right.
you need to partner with the country, that's ideal, partner with these countries where they're coming from, and to work with them to get into the lead.
Well, and when it does come into international waters, it does become something the military has some jurisdiction over. But that's always been done in the past by boarding.
Exactly.
Right, it's the equivalent of due process, right?
We're now boarding the boat.
ICE grabs somebody, deports him, and then discovers it was a mistake. We bomb the boat, blow it up, and then discover, oops. Except that oops is a little hard to undo when you've just killed 11 people.
Just to take seconds on this, Joe, the irony here to me is that if you look at Trump's conflict with Venezuela, which we've talked about, Colombia, and now the $20 billion that the United States is putting at risk in this false bailout of Argentina. And just to give the highlights on that, you've got Scott Bessent, a guy who made money on the other side of countries defending their currency. So saying, don't worry, I'm going to give them $20 billion and it's going to be over. That's like the world's most successful card counter running the hotline for Gamblers Anonymous. It doesn't make any sense. He's a poster child for just the obvious. But I must have missed it, because if you add all of this up, when Trump said America first, he must really have been trying to say America's first, and all of his mega acolytes just missed the S. Because I certainly missed that S when it came to what he was going to focus on in this administration.
$20 billion.
anyone else on that? All right. Just real quick, the story that is breaking as we speak is that, and you all can help me with the last names here, but Portland Trailblazers head coach Chauncey Billups.
Yeah.
And Miami Heat guard Terry Rozier,
yeah,
were arrested Thursday in connection with an FBI investigation into illegal gambling activities involving sports betting and poker, according to federal authorities. The press conference for this continues. It is going on. Around 30 people are currently in custody in connection with the schemes, with more expected to surrender themselves later. Justice Department spokesman John Merzulli said Thursday both Billups and Rozier are expected to appear in federal court today. Billups in Portland, Rozier in Orlando. They will be arraigned on indictments in New York at a future date. This is the Portland Trailblazers head coach and the Miami Heat guard arrested in connection with an FBI investigation into illegal gambling activities involving sports betting and poker, according to federal authorities. So,
was it Claude Rains, who was the actor in Casablanca, who entered Rick's
shocked.
Cafe?
Yes,
I'm shocked.
Yeah, he's shocked.
Shocked that there's gambling.
Well,
there we are.
And I'm shocked that you've got a gambling issue that may have nothing to do with, but nevertheless, all the major sports leagues have embraced gambling. And I mean, obviously this is breaking as we go, so I don't know the details of this big story, but the whole intramural love affair that the pro sports has with legalized gambling gives me reason for pause, or makes me think this was only a matter of time.
Yeah, exactly. This was foreseeable and avoidable, but inevitable once we made the decisions around sports betting we've made in this country.
Well, that's right. And to Ira's point, and it is, I still can't believe that it's even allowed. But let's say baseball, a batter gets up to bat, and there on the left-hand side, it tells you what the current odds are of how much money you can make from the affiliated betting institution that they have partnered with, and what you can make, and a $5 bet will get you this if he does this, 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 or this. And on the bottom of the screen, all the information is there. And in sports arenas around this country, there are actual betting parlors and terminals within the arenas where you can go and bet on it. So how can you be shocked that the players and the coaches are getting involved in it?
Yeah, and never mind.
And by the way, I'm not forgiving what they did by any stretch of the imagination.
Or alleged to have done,
thank you. But still.
Well, never mind the harm we're causing typically to younger, not well-off males in this country as well, right? This whole story is not... I said this, if you look back at the tapes, as this was proliferating, that this wasn't going to end well. I don't know that this particular incident will cause the end of it or cause for us to curtail what we're doing, but this was a sordid endeavor from the start, and it will be ugly and end badly.
Yeah, and I know this from teaching, and I know this also from just my own family, but all these kids, males who are interested in sports, I mean, they have like three apps going at any given time, and it's unbelievable. It's so easy.
You can bet from play to play, not just game to game, from play to play.
Yeah. I mean, you can put a bet on if number 27 is coming up next to bat. You say, well, is 27 going to get a hit? Are they going to get an out? And you can bet on all of that.
And there's by the way, just to explain, there's a reason for that, because if you bet Bills Giants who wins,
right,
you get a very robust market. People take both sides, and you can set your odds accordingly, and the house takes a cut. When you're betting what's called a parlay bet, a one-off, strange bet, particularly if you string them together, will X player get a hit, Y player get struck out, and Z player throw X many strikeouts? When you string that together, there is no robust market. So the bookmakers take a huge chunk of profit off of those bets. That's why you're seeing the promotion of the peculiar bets that you're seeing.
And they're because the award to them, especially to the young people, is that you can make good money if you win, but the chances of it are getting a superfecta.
But in financial terms, if you make a bet and the odds are fair, that's a fair bet. Well, but in those cases when the house is taking so much of a cut, it's an unfair bet from the start. So that you're a loser the minute you put down the bet, even if you play 1,000 of them. Whereas if you're good at betting games and you play 1,000 of them, you actually may make a profit. In parlays, that's almost impossible for an individual to do.
To be fair, there are basketball in particular has had scandals in the past that predate the current gambling circumstances. You got the point shaving scandal at CCNY in the 50s. All the way up to the recent years where an NBA referee was arrested on this. Oh, so yeah. This point shaving is apparently easy to do if you're meant to do it.
The 1900s Black Sox.
They're going to baseball, but other than Pete Rose, there haven't been a lot of baseball instances. Yep.
Cash Patel says this is the insider trading saga for the NBA, and he is sporting his FBI jacket as we speak. We'll pause there. My thanks to our entire group, Ira, Jim, Mark, Sienna. You're wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your paying attention to this matter.
We'll be back right after this.